Hi, welcome back to Panic Pixie Scream Girls. We had a short break after Christmas, but now we're back with even more. This time we're talking about The Witch, and we've got a guest. But we just wanted to let you know, there are some content warnings. A full list is available in the description, but we do discuss things like death, mental illness, witchcraft, the devil, abuse, sexual exploitation, Catholicism, puberty, infanticide. So just be aware. It's going to be fun.
Hello, this is Panic Pixie Scream Girls, a podcast about horror and anxiety with Holly and Becky. I'm Holly and this is Becky. Say hi, Becky.
Hello.
Hello.
And today we have a guest with us, which is Toby Reynolds from the podcast Dr. Kino's Film Emporium. Say hello, Toby.
Hello. No, hello. Sorry, that was my attempt at a scary voice. Hello, it's actually a pleasure to be here with the Panic Pixies.
It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you.
And we've been on your podcast twice now, haven't we?
Yes, you have. Fine episodes too. So much appreciated.
Too kind. So today we're going to talk about Robert Eggers' film The Witch, which came out in 2015. It's a film that's set in New England about a Puritan family who have been cast out from their community, essentially for the father being too fundamentalist or too religious in some way. And they've gone on to live near the edge of a forest and built a farm, and they're trying to survive on their own as a family. And cue spooky happenings and witchy things. First of all, should we talk to Toby about what he does and why he does a podcast?
I'm glad you asked. I started doing a podcast like a lot of people, I imagine, in lockdown last year. But there is a more rationale behind it in that I am a film academic and writer. And podcasting to be a natural sort of next thing to do. Plus, as well, in academia, you have to have a lot of strings to your bow if you are to get anywhere with job applications as well. And plus the fact that I just really enjoy talking about film with people who also enjoy talking about film and who also know probably more than I do about film. Seemed to be a really nice fit. And it's been a lot of fun. I've done a number of episodes now and had a lot of fun doing it. So researching it and chatting to some people and getting some fantastic film recommendations.
Great. So this is a podcast about horror. So what scares you?
In a general sense, last year scared me a lot. This year's definitely approaching the same. So apart from normal existential stuff, which we've all been exposed to, I think. In terms of film, I've got to say horror films, I've always enjoyed them. I think they're a bit of a guilty pleasure with a lot of film academics and writers, although they no pleasure should be guilty unless it adds something to it. But horror is, there's a lot of being written about horror and theorized about horror, but I think for a long time it was a kind of sort of the unwanted orphan at the party type thing in many ways. It was seen as a bit too populist and cheap and nasty and things. That said, I think fear is a really fundamental human emotion that we all experience at some point. So it is really natural that film should deal with this sort of thing. And I'm very lucky to be teaching this year, although obviously by remote. And one of the films I'm teaching is Nosferatu from 1922. Mm. And that is, just going back on it again, was just how iconic some of the whole sort of vampire stuff is. The shadows and the German expressionist thing. So, I mean, horror's been around a long, long time film. And I think for when I was a child, it was definitely back in the day when there were only four channels and three channels, I actually remember, and just having three channels before Channel 4 turned up. And the horror films were on late at night. So you really had to either sneak down and watch them without your parents knowing, which was pretty difficult to do. Or you went to a friend's house whose parents were a bit more liberal or just didn't care and rented a video cassette from, and generally try to get something as, nearer to an 18 as possible.
Yeah, that was my house. I was the person that had the pet. We didn't care.
Okay.
So, yeah.
You were the cool kid who's like, my mum's out. Yeah, my mum and dad are out. So, yeah, let's go and watch an 18 video from somewhere with lots of blood. So, I mean, the films that scare me are it's the jump scares. I'm such a shocker for jump scares. I get suckered in every time with the music build up. You know something's going to happen. I actually sort of put my hands in front of my face, if I'm being absolutely honest.
Yeah, me too.
I did that at St. Maud last year, which I managed to see because I knew something was coming. And there's a jump scare towards the end and it scared the bejesus out of me. So So jump scares do get me, but I think the films that gets me the most are the, and this is where The Witch definitely comes in, is when you, it's unsettling, and a film can haunt you, I think. A really good film. This haunted me, this film. This got to me in ways I didn't really appreciate at the time. And it did undermine a lot of things I had inside. And it was, I think, partly because it was really authentic. Dialogue is incredible. We'll probably go into that later. But it was this sort of terrible breakdown of our family on screen. And that's, that unsettled me a lot. And there's also, with horror films, if the universe is a balanced place, which apparently in physics it generally is, then there should have been something on the side of God or the good, but there wasn't. And that's really quite disturbing as well. I think the best sort of horror films really mess with your head in that sense. They shake your fundamental beliefs about things, and that's what this film did for me.
That's quite interesting. I definitely want to pick that up later, because I think that's almost the opposite of the way I think about it. So that's very interesting. So the kind of horror films you like are sort of those slow burn, scary films. So thinking of things like Rosemary's Baby, It Follows, what else?
Shining. Still I saw The Shining all the way through quite late in my, say in my life, in my mid-30s. I think it was on Channel 4 or something. And I had to, I was actually watching it in my house on my own on that Saturday night, and it scared the crap out of me. And I had to keep turning over, because every sound, it just gets under your skin, that film. It'd be like The Witch, but in a different way. And there's this terrible build, and you know that bad things are going to start happening. And they do happen. And then Kubrick was genius and just dropped all these little things in with the twins, etc., and in the hallway, and just horror. And every sound suddenly was something scary, and it built up and built up. And it's a very effective job of scaring. So,
this good film that is going to be the subject of our next podcast, isn't it, Holly? Because we both really enjoyed that as well. So, why have you picked this film to talk to us about?
I think because I think out of recent films, and I'd probably say St. Maud affects me in a similar way, although it didn't resonate for as long as The Witch did. So 2015, back in normal times, and it wasn't near Halloween either, I don't think, was it? It was sort of more like a spring, I think, March time. The reason why I remember it is because I went away for Easter with my other half to Cornwall. We went camping, and we'd seen it about 2 or 3 weeks previously, and we were on our own in the campsite, and there's lots of kind of very Tim Burton-esque trees fringing the campsite next to YHA in Cornwall. And the storm Katie blew in as well. And this film, I just kept remembering this bloody film, and it kept the wind kept going. The world suddenly seemed a dangerous, scary place with things abroad. And you can imagine probably one or two of the witches from The Witch, you know, probably summoning up a storm and riding it and cackling away. And, you know, I knew that wasn't the case, but it was an irrational fear, and it just wouldn't let me go. And it was really like, what the hell? You know, this is ridiculous. And, you know, I was a grown man, sort of scared of a film I'd seen about 3 weeks ago. So
that's really interesting.
This hadn't happened to me in quite a long time. A film hadn't got to me, I think, in that time. So when you asked me about which film, I thought, okay, and it pops in. Mm-hmm. I thought, this has got to be done, because it's on very old tropes as well. It's a classic horror film in many ways, but I think it does it in a very, very skillful way. If this was his first film, I mean, I've seen The Lighthouse as well, which is the second one, which just was brilliant, but it didn't get to me the same way the first one did for some reason. So
I haven't watched that yet, but Holly loves that film.
So, I mean, but it's just really funny. It's hilarious.
There's some really funny moments in it. It's really quite disturbing as well.
It's just my sense of humour.
It's one way of coping with fear, I think, is that we laugh at it, it's lessen its impact. William Dafoe is just fantastically cast in The Lighthouse.
I love him anyway.
He's got such
My stew.
Mad staring eyes, like boring into you. And it was but his first, I mean, that's his first film. It's incredibly a short debut, and a lot of directors do horror because it's their first. It can be quite cheap to do. I think It Follows, And I think the guy did Under the Silver Lake, which I enjoyed, but found quite preposterous as well. But the horror is often the first choice, and a lot of filmmakers go on to do other things, which I think is a shame, because The Witch just thought was just a brilliant, brilliant debut by Robert Eggers. And so the research showed in as well, the dialogue, I think he basically lifted it wholesale from court records. Salem in Massachusetts. Like, you know, he absolutely nailed the dialogue, I thought, really well.
Yeah, I think I read that it took him 4 years of preparation to kind of get the film off the ground. So he was Frenched in the research. And so it's really accurate, which is interesting and clearly adds to the atmosphere.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it feels very authentic, which makes the actual events in it even more chilling as well. Because you think, but what if it really did happen like that? You know, his family sort of mysteriously disappeared. Like, well, you know, so...
Well, he's obviously achieved his intention because he said in an interview at the time that one of the reasons that he wanted to do the film was to kind of make witches scary again, because I think it has become almost like a sort of amusing comedy trope of horror in a way, and often witches are not portrayed as particularly scary. They're often in the more children's kind of part of things. So this was about making witches truly terrifying again.
Yeah.
That's really interesting, because I think I was wanting to ask you, like, what you found scary about it, because it doesn't scare me in that way. I mean, there are some images that are very shocking.
Yes.
But I think, if anything, I was worried about what would happen to Thomasin and what her parents were going to do to her, and that no one believed her. But the witch itself didn't scare me in the same way.
I think for me, I mean, this is possibly the biggest fear is the unknown, because this is what really got to me about this film, is that you do not see the witch, see aspects of her, but she is this unseen presence, and her presence is noted straight away because the baby is taken, and this is, you know, obviously child kidnap and baby kidnap. That's quite strong stuff.
In fact,
sorry.
And then murder of the child.
And the murdered. And made into an ointment, which allows her to fly or something. Because that's what witches did. And you actually think about the sort of, it's implied. I mean, the baby's in the witch's hut. And then there's a knife next to it or something. And you think, oh no, oh no, oh no. And that's really brought home. But it's the unseen presence. So your mind is the thing that scares you. And he didn't show the witch. And I think that's much, much scarier. Very much like Jaws. You don't see the shark. And you know, you see bits of it, and obviously what happens when the shark is there until towards the end. And it makes it much scarier as a result. I think he did exactly the same with The Witch. And I think he trusts the process in this film, in that I got the impression that he treats the audience with a lot of intelligence, as if they, you know, they're smart. We are smart, you know, audiences. We know what's coming. And there's little bits and pieces just to sort of, you know, whet your appetite and just let it build. And that's much, much stronger. And I think running parallel with this sort of unseen threat that's growing in the woods, you know that there's something in the woods, is the effect that it has on the family. And this is a film about family breakdown. And you feel for them, I think, because he's obviously Ralph Ineson, plays the father, and he's not very competent. You know, there's a sort of, they're not doing that well. And he's thinking, you will probably have to swallow your pride and go back to the main town at some point. But, you know, this man's a stubborn, holy, righteous fool. And, you know, he's dragging his family along too. And he's put his family in danger. And this is like, just move back to the town. Say you're sorry. Say you were wrong. No, you're not going to do that, are you? Oh, my God. And all these things are just, you're seeing this breakdown of the family fracturing before your eyes. They kind of turn upon each other. And the children are sort of with Black Philip, the goats, which of course is, you know, he's thinking, yeah, goats are not usually very good in these kind of films. You know, there's usually sort of harbingers or familiars of evil. And it turns out to be correct as well. And that was a jump scare for me, which when Black Philip butted him, I think that was like, jump back in my seat.
I mean, that was very surprising.
Very surprising. Was not expecting that at all. It wasn't a happy ending. In a sense, it wasn't in a way. And this is where this is the genius of the film, is that the ambiguity, the Puritan life is not particularly, it's like hard, it's hard work, women are not particularly treated very well, putting it mildly. And the devil presumably appears to Thomasin and goes, wouldst thou live marvelously or something
deliciously
deliciously deliciously. And it's sort of, Yeah. You're thinking, yeah, I can see the appeal of that. Yeah. And then, you know, she goes off and there's a witch's Sabbath in the woods and they're all dancing naked and rising up through the air, and she joins it and thinking, so there's a sort of, there's a corruption, I think, of the family. There's a breakdown, and this is where America was seen as this sort of, you know, wild, dangerous place. Yeah, maybe, but at the same time, the woods are always seen as a dangerous place, I think, in horror films, and, you know, rightly so, and the witch lives in the woods. But I think it was a number of things going on, and there was a sense of inevitability that things were not going to end well. You just knew from the beginning things were not going to end well, and they didn't. And it's like, ah, yeah. So I forget how the mother, Kate Dickey, I forget how she died.
She tried to kill Thomason, and Thomason had to stab her in self-defense.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you see this fracture, this sort of family turning upon each other, the sort of paranoia and you know, the sort of accusations of possession. And it's kind of like,
Sorry, Becky, were you saying it's not self-defense?
Well, no, it is self-defense in that she attacks her and she hits her. But then it goes too far where... There's a point where she could have not killed her. She's hurt her and she could have probably got away. But at that point, she just, her anger, I think, comes out, and then she takes it out and she's like, it's really kind of, I've had enough of this, right? Mm. And she's like striking back. So I think that's the point at which Thomason begins to take her power back, where she's just like, screw the lot of you. Like, you've put me through hell. Yeah, that's it.
It reminded me a bit of Carrie and her mum.
Yeah.
Kind of, yeah. Religious zealotry and kind of turning on the teenage daughter, because she's kind of like a object of envy and resentment, and you know, she accuses her of trying to seduce her father and her brother, and you know, just sees her as very dangerous, and you know, that there's not room for her in the family anymore, that she's growing into a woman, there's only one woman allowed in this household.
That's horrible, the way they did turn on each other. And are you thinking, is that the influence of the witch, or is it, would it have happened anyway with or without a witch? I mean,
so that's where I think, like, probably, I don't know, I'm guessing because I know Holly. I think that's probably where
I've still got a few tricks up my sleeve, surprises.
In that you probably view it as sort of in the way that I was just describing, as kind of more of a powerful kind of rejection of that religious idolatry and like fervor, and kind of taking herself back and taking back her life. And so you probably don't see it as scary so much.
No, I think it's more the life, the Puritan life seemed very oppressive, the kind of very strict family. And I mean, she's kind of basically their servant for childcare, and but then still it's never enough. And yeah, and just scary that her parents are going to turn on her and like harm her. And you know, because I mean, right up until the end, she hasn't actually done anything wrong. So then it's almost like, well, you know, I tried to do the right thing and I told the truth and look what's happened. So I might as well just have my devil butter and dancing.
And live deliciously.
Yeah.
So like for me, there's two kind of, this film is about danger, but there's two dangers. There's the danger of religion and the danger of falling into that religious fervor. And then there's also the danger of the patriarchal society and how it damages the women and how they don't have a voice. And she's property. They're saying that they're going to send her off to work for somebody else in order to get money to keep the family going and stuff. So she has no agency. She has no voice. They don't believe her. And she's coming of age, as you talked about. She's had her first blood, so she's reached puberty. And through a lot of the films that we've discussed, there is that kind of danger of women, particularly when they get to that sexual age, and how it links into that, those themes around original sin, doesn't it? So it's how you can't trust women, they will seduce you and ruin you.
I'm not anti-religion, you know, I mean, it does a lot for a lot of people, but it's more kind of religious oppression, and particularly around kind of sex and sexuality and stuff. I think that's kind of, that has done a lot of harm to a lot of people in their childhood and adolescent, to kind of deny these natural urges.
Indeed. For me as well, I think there's a third danger, and that is the witch is dangerous and the devil is dangerous. They're waiting I mean, I think the kind of old school religion of like the devil's waiting to tempt you, and that kind of literally is true. I mean, there's the patriarchal religion, but there's also, in a sense, there's a patriarchal darker spiritual energy with the devil and his sort of willing servants, the witches in the woods. And it's kind of like, oh, okay. So there's not much hope, I think, in this film. There's no kind of redemption. There's kind of, you can't win either way. Either you get taken by the devil or the witches, or you'll get some patriarchal religious in the town, or, you know, the Puritans will get you as well, and your life will be miserable anyway. So it's kind of like, well,
either way, it's not
either great. Way, you're screwed. You know, it's kind of like, and that's where this film is. It scared me, just not only because it's just, I think, very, very well crafted. It's beautifully shot as well. There's a sort of washed out, the woods really do look quite a dangerous and pleasant place. And
it's very drab, isn't it? Very gloomy, very
yeah,
colour.
Yeah, there's a sense of rotting as well. And everything seems to be loaded with this kind of sort of sense of, you know, corruption.
Are you religious at all, Toby? Or did you grow up with any kind of faith? What does it mean to you then?
What does it mean?
Seems like in the film it was very real to you.
It felt very real, partly because of the dialogue, partly because I think, as you said, he took 4 years to do it. And I think that really shows, I think, the degree of verisimilitude to the costumes and the way of speaking. You could really believe, all films are really manipulative and they suture you into their sort of reality, their story, their diegesis. And I think he took a lot of care with that. And so it's very believable. But for me, no, I was fortunate enough to be, my family were quite alternative in some way. So my father had Buddhist beliefs. I had a lot of family members who were vegetarian, and in they also practiced alternative medicine, or complementary medicine, I should say, still do. So we kind of were a little bit kind of middle class, unconventional, but we weren't formally religious. So as an not an outsider, but somebody who knows stuff but wasn't actually raised in a faith as such, it's interesting to sort of see a pretty kind of tortured view of spirituality. And this is where it's kind of like, whoa, that was quite disturbing. One of the reasons why, because you can't win in this particular world. There's in the world of the witch, there's sort of not much, there's not much to enjoy, or there's very little redemption.
Because you said there's almost no heaven, there's only hell or real life, which is miserable drudgery.
which is
interesting about that though. If you think about Caleb, so Caleb is one of the sons of the family, and he disappears at one point and has a sort of kind of sexual experience, I guess, with the witch, where she kisses him and then he comes back and he's
that's the implication.
Yeah. And he's really ill and they don't know what's wrong with him. Is it because he's been in the elements exposed and has a fever and, you know, all of those things, or is he possessed? And then he starts ranting and raving. He coughs up an apple, which is apparently
brilliant touch.
Shows an apple with a bite taken out of it, which shows that he's been possessed, but is also a link back to that original sin. Adam and Eve, the apple, you know, all of that. So it's, the symbolism of that is great. And the scene is horrific, isn't it?
It is. Really,
he's an amazing actor in that. It's just crazy.
Coughing up the apple was like, oh, okay. And then again, this family are totally helpless. You can sort of feel their pain.
Yeah, they just don't know what to do.
But there's nothing they can do. And she, the like praying away, and you know, it's not going to work. And then he's like, and then throws up his ball, and it's like, what the hell? You know,
his bit where he dies, he has this kind of like religious sort of redemption moment, but does he? It's very sexualized in a way. He starts ranting about God, but it's God touching him, kissing him, caressing him. And after everything you've kind of seen, and the fact that he's having, throughout the beginning of the film, he's having his sexual awakening. There's no other females there. So he's sort of coveting his sister, which is wrong, but perhaps understandable in the circumstance. And so you've got all of that kind of sexual repression and kind of him grappling with that. And then he dies. And I'm not sure whether that's actually, it comes across as though he's ascending to heaven, but it also could be descending to hell, depending on the reading. Quite ambiguous.
Yeah, because then the mother talks about her as a young woman, her kind of religious awakening, and like it's says, I was so ravished by his love for me, and then like no husband can compare and stuff. But then she's kind of lost that as a married woman.
He's inadequate in lots of ways, isn't he, the husband?
I know. And then when Thomason's just like, all you can do is chop wood.
And he can't even hunt properly.
And then the wood pile falls on him at the end.
It's like, no. kind of poetic, really. Yeah, I mean, he turns up naked, doesn't he? I mean, he finds the witch's hut in the forest, and there's the monstrous feminine, I think, is kind of definitely signaled, because there's a shot, you don't see the witch properly, but you see her hand, and it's kind of deformed and scaly and unpleasant. You're thinking, oh no, Caleb, don't go there. Oh no, he's gone there. And there's the forbidden fruit, being the apple, etc. So, as you said, loaded with symbolism, and it is a horrific scene. There is this sort of sense that he's had his virginity or innocence ripped from him. Mm. He's been ravished, etc. So there's, in many ways, that masculinity is very fragile in this film. It's very inadequate in so many ways. The father shows that as well, that he can't, you know, he can't look after his family, he can't protect his family. Yeah. Caleb is, as a sort of blossoming young man, he's very vulnerable to the monstrous feminine, possibly in this case, shadow femininity, which is on show here from the witch. And yeah, I think just with the woods as well, I'm interested in sort of Jungian and post-Jungian takes on film and screen generally. And you could argue that the actual location, the woods, is a female space in the fences of fertility. So there's lots of different aspects to femininity in this film. And I think one of those is shadow femininity embodied by the witch, but also that's inflected, I think, as well, and shadow masculinity as well, but very a very fragile one, and sort of very arrogant, narrow-minded masculinity and from the father, whose pride basically means they're driven out of the thing. So he puts his family in danger. His masculinity has done that. And they're on the edge of the wild, and he didn't really know what he's getting into. And there's a sort of, if you're going to gender it, you could say that the woods are a feminine space, and it's a very powerful feminine space, where at the end there's a witch's sabbat. But I think even before then, there was, you know, he's gone into it and he doesn't know what he's doing, and he's not skilled in any way, he doesn't respect the feminine, and as a result comes a cropper.
Well, in terms of the kind of shadow femininity as well, the scene with the mother when she kind of hallucinates her dead children visiting her, and it's because the devil's making a bargain with her that she'll get to see her children again, and then she's breastfeeding, but then it turns back and it's like a raven pecking at her breast.
Oh, yeah,
I think that was one of the most shocking
yes
ones, actually.
There's some shocking imagery. Definitely. So there's a sense of them being toyed with. I mean, the devil is also present, but you never see him either.
It's sort of a whisper, and we assume it's coming from the goat.
yes, Black Philip, which is just a great name. But
that would be so funny if he spoke in the voice of a goat.
Yes. Live delicious.
Was that live delicious? Live. Probably would take away some of the skin.
I think it may end up a bit of a parody, but I think it bears repeating viewing, I think, this film. I'm not sure I'd want to, because it disturbed me so much the first time around, possibly because I saw it at the cinema. But yeah, it did echo around, and there was, I think the best horror films do that. They do, they get under your skin, they disturb you, they unsettle you, and this one really did it for me. Like I said, I think he succeeded in making witches scary. I caught a little bit of Hansel and Gretel Witch Hunters, and that's much more of a sort of almost comedy action film. And witches are kind of scary in that, but they're overtly scary. This is very much covertly scary. It's what,
and it's malevolent, isn't it? It's like, it's more
There is, yeah. There's a cruelty and a malevolence in this film, and it's implied in many ways. And the ending as well is quite bleak. There's a bleakness to this film.
I don't view the ending as bleak.
It's awesome. The ending's ambiguity. Yeah. It is in a way, but then it's also, will she turn into this monstrous feminine? Will she have her own hut in the woods where she'll...
It's all right. She's a homeowner.
Not to be sniffed at. There's bonuses for it if it's that, or going to town where she'll be the sort of skivvy.
I mean, there are some killing babies, but you know.
Yeah, I don't know why that didn't upset me more. I think just like because the baby looked like quite happy. I know in the scene that the baby does get murdered, but I think it didn't worry me watching it again just because the baby actor looked. Can babies be act? I don't know.
Yeah.
Babies can be actors. Yeah,
they just look very relaxed. They didn't look scared or anything. They just looked. Yeah,
yeah. I see what you're saying. I don't know. I do find it horrifying. That scene is creepy, and the way it's shot, because you don't see very much, and it's kind of by candlelight. And there's something kind of sexual about the way she touches the baby, which disturbs me as well. But I kind of know what you mean. You know, you're not seeing her stabbing the baby to death in front of your eyes.
And so it's implication.
Because it could be, something I noticed when I watched it this time, because I watched it again before we talked about this, is it takes on another meaning when you watch it now. Because, so there's this, like, the woods have a very kind of claustrophobic feel, don't they? There's a very claustrophobic feel to the whole film because they only live on their farm and then they've got these woods surrounding them and they feel that this evil presence or whatever's happening feels very kind of around them and on them. So it is quite a claustrophobic film. But then there's also this massive sense of isolation, and that just kind of really rung through to me in these current times where you're sort of isolated from everybody. Yeah. It just felt really kind of... I wouldn't have thought about it the last time I watched the film, but this time it did feel very reminiscent of some of the feelings that we're all kind of going through right now.
For sure.
Yeah, I think the claustrophobia of the family, I think just like that the people you live with, you absolutely rely on each other for survival and you're stuck with each other.
Yeah.
No offence to my lovely housemates. Shout out to Claire and Steve.
There's a sense of paranoia and stuff, but to me, I kind of view, like, for Toby, you find it disturbing, that dissolution of the family, and there are other films where I've seen that happen and I do find it disturbing, for example in Hereditary, but in this film I'm kind of okay with it in a way. Like, they're breaking themselves.
Yeah, that's
they're,
the tragedy.
They're breaking themselves through their own shame. Like, there's so much shame. It's very, I know it's a slightly different religion, but it, having been brought up around Catholicism, it's very present for me, that original sin.
Guilt
that's
and shame, definitely.
Guilt and shame. And I feel it very much in this film, and it feels like they've brought it on themselves. They're burdening themselves up and tying themselves in knots by having so much shame about every aspect of their life and not being honest and open with each other about anything. There's a lot of secrets and tiny sins, which are not really sins, but then they make it into a big thing. And internally, at the end, they're breaking free of that and letting it go. So I guess I'm sort of more attracted to the to the devil and the darkness, because it feels like that's about being free.
Yeah, you can see where the attraction is, sort of, you know, the saying the devil has the best tunes, and it's kind of, this is the, again, part for me, part of the bleakness of the film is that what should be a source of joy, your sort of religion and your relationship with God and spirit, is anything but. And it's kind of, it's been replaced by the devil and his works and his servants. And you're thinking, that's kind of the wrong way around. And I think America has got a very, very Puritan nature to it. It's got a very conflicted view of sexuality, a very conflicted view of pleasure as well. Yeah. And this is where I think the preparation for it, I think he really nailed that kind of Puritan sort of agony that they're in most of the time. I mean, I think Paul Schrader, who director, writer, you know, Taxi Driver and the rest of it, he and his brother Leonard were brought up in Dutch Reformed Calvinist Church. And it's been described as being the sort of religious equivalent of depression, of clinical depression. You're born a sinner, you'll die a sinner. The only thing, that any kind of redemption, is you have to do your absolute best in this life and you may get into heaven or not.
Yeah.
And it's just this kind of, you just can't win. You're set up to fail in that particular thing. I think that sort of very Protestant sense of just permeates through the film. And like I said, I think it's so claustrophobic. The language, I think, really helps, and just the sort of mentality and mindset. You can't dismiss their fears because they are actually living in the woods. These witches are living in the woods. It's like, oh.
So happens at a certain point in the film. The father character is describing to Caleb, the son, who's got really upset just talking to his father, and he's asking him, will the baby that's disappeared, will he go to heaven? Because if he was born a sinner, like, have he had enough time to not be a sinner anymore and get to heaven? And his father can't answer him and is like, well, I don't know. It's in God's hands. And then he's worried about himself because he knows that he's sinned. And so will he ever get to heaven? And he gets really upset about that. There's a sense from the father that he can't comfort his son at all. He just says, you know, it's not in our hands. We have to let that go. That's for God to decide. And it's not kind of good enough, you know, and it leaves.
Inadequate. Upset. Yeah, he's so inadequate in so many ways, the father. I've felt for him in many ways. Like, I was very conflicted feelings for him, because this is a man whose pride led his family to be thrown out. So he didn't have to, you know, he could have accepted
He was given an opportunity to apologize and get on
with it. He didn't take it. Yeah. And it's like, okay, well, then see how you get on, you know, on your own. And this is where, I mean, certainly in America, it can be seen as a critique of individualism to this film. And I think the sense that you need a community around you for protection, if nothing else. But also, you just need a community, you need other people. You need a community. It's as simple as that. There's,
yes, we do.
yes, we do.
Yeah. We're social animals. Humans are social animals. And we do best in groups. And we always have done. I think the film is also flagging up the danger of isolation and in these,
they could have all just gone crazy. They could have just gone mad.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say I would have given it a couple of years with or without any witches. They probably would have lost the plot or starved, or you know, they would have been forced to go back to the town, I think, and you know, duly humbled, minus a few of them possibly, especially because it's usually the kids that die of starvation or malnutrition, etc. Obviously the witch was like in a sense a catalyst for that, but yeah, the sense that if you're outside the group, you're prey to these darker spiritual forces, I think, was that's, again, it was like, oh, that's quite scary to actually think about that as well. So I think Eggers did just a brilliant job on this film. The job was to scare people. It scared me. It unsettled me deeply.
Yeah, I think I kind of have a view that it's saying, as well as talking about the dangers of religion and stuff, it's kind of a takedown of that masculinity, that patriarchy, and the fact that he is inadequate and the fact that all of that kind of doesn't help him. None of it helps him.
No.
And actually, it ends up the mother and Thomasin are the ones holding everything together. They are the powerful ones, but they are also the ones that kind of are not given power and not given the voice. So it's kind of a takedown of that, and then it flips it on its head and it becomes, they take it back, she takes it back, as this powerful woman coming of age as a scary witch up a tree by the end of it.
Yeah. Symbolically, she sheds her clothes as well, this whole Puritan thing, and goes in. It's like she comes into herself in that sense. And yeah, I think it's a great performance from Anya Taylor-Joy, I think.
Yeah, it was just love anyway.
I think for me.
Have you seen Thoroughbreds?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, that was...
I haven't.
Flipping dark, but it was really good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the Queen's Gambit.
Like sort of privileged.
Oh,
the Queen's Gambit was fantastic.
She's just really so good at that.
Brilliant job. Yeah, definitely. She got enormous eyes as well. She looks quite alien-like. I think there's some people like David Bowie very alien-like. I think Anya Taylor-Joy also looks like an alien because her eyes are very wide and they're very large. It's like, okay, if she was cast as an alien, I would believe it. And that's a compliment.
We should talk about the use of nudity in the film. Because, I think also this is even relating to some of the films we've seen previously and talked about in terms of especially older women's bodies being used in horror. And, like, the more I thought about it, the more examples I could think of.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I was going to say the bit with the baby and, again, the bit at the end where I think they possibly are chopping up the other children. There's the blood and you see them sort of pulling at intestines and stuff, which is really quite horrific, and covering themselves in blood. There's a sense when Caleb sees the witch and she kisses him, she's a beautiful woman, and you only see that for a very minuscule moment. But the other times that you see the witch, it's as an old crony woman, horrible. So you kind of get the sense that they're ancient as well. They've been around for a long time and shape-shifting stuff. So there's kind of an interesting sense between the kind of beautiful young woman enticing and seducing the boy and then this kind of horrible crone.
They're very old tropes. They're very old archetypes, if I can get you in. And I think they're there for a reason. I think certainly culturally, the sort of cultural unconscious, if I could advance that idea, I think certain culturally specific symbols have a lot of resonance with certain audiences. So, yeah, I think in America, because of the Puritan aspect, as a frontier country and quite a young country, there's that might have actually deeper resonance than perhaps other nations or cultures would have, especially with the apple and the crone, the mother, the maiden, etc. as well. So yeah, there's different versions of those in different cultures. They've all got their particular flavor in that culturally specific way. I think for the witch, there's obviously the Puritans came from England as well, so there's a shared sense of cultural symbols. So
I mean, also kind of old-fashioned kind of misogyny and ageism.
Oh, yeah.
In itself, seeing an old woman naked is truly shocking and horrifying moment. Since so many things in Hereditary, and I was thinking of The Shining as well, because then with the woman in Room 237, and like that she starts as a young, beautiful woman and then suddenly changes to an old woman, and that was quite a lot, like when Caleb kisses the witch and then her hand is all gnarled.
Yes.
Yeah, Game of Thrones. With Melisandre.
True. Yeah. Yeah, the sort of, it's the fluid femininity, isn't it? In this sense, there's a sort of, I think, a definite archetypes going on, certainly there's symbolically in this film. There's a shifting, as you said, a shape shifting. That is scary too. There's a very powerful femininity, and shadows aren't necessarily bad. It's the unacknowledged or the repressed things. And this is where, yeah, you get they've obviously found a way to prolong their life and to alter their appearance. And it's kind of, ooh. Dark magic, but there's, I think, it's a specific
hair, isn't there? A hair that appears a couple of times, like
yes,
in the woods, and then they see it later on. Thomasina sees it in the barn, and you get the sense that the hair is the witch looking back at them,
or the familiar or something.
I thought maybe it was a familiar.
It's kind of, this is where I think the genius of the film is, it's the ambiguity of it. It's not spelled out. It could just be a hair, but it probably isn't. Yeah, the League of Gentlemen, they've got a guy called Jeremy Dyson who doesn't appear in there, but he does write. And he writes a series of short stories called Never Trust a Rabbit. He basically said that rabbits are really sinister. You know, this is not Watership Down type thing. It was anything but Watership Down. Again, Watership Down's quite a disturbing film as well.
Oh, God. Yeah, I mean, there's some pretty disturbing bunnies in that.
Yeah. Gosh. So... But rabbits are, I think, in the hair in this one, definitely there's something evil about it. There's the sort of glassy eyes. And
in pagan sort of religions, I think the hair is kind of a fertility symbol, isn't it?
Yes.
Spring and fertility and stuff.
Yeah, again, the sexuality coming through as well, yeah. I think sexuality in this film is seen as something very dangerous. There's, obviously Caleb has his encounter, ends up naked and sort of, completely traumatized by it. There's a sense at the end as well. You can probably imagine that the husband and wife probably didn't enjoy it very much as well. There's a sort of, it's either necessary evil or seen as a necessary evil. But there's a feminine sexuality here, which is powerful and dangerous. And
with a lot of the films that we've looked at and discussed, it tends to follow that when women come of age, that's when the bad, scary stuff happens. And that's a common trope within horror. Which in some ways does echo our own experiences of life, for sure. You know, lots of difficult things happen to you and your body when you hit puberty and unexplained things. You know, you go through periods of trauma and difficultness as you traverse that time in your life. So it does sort of make sense. But also it's kind of a negative, I was feel it's quite a negative stereotype, particularly for women, that it's essentially that once women reach that age, they're no longer innocent and they are not to be trusted.
On a wider level, I think that's partly to do with the fact that we don't form initiation rituals, healthy initiation rituals for young people. Mm. And there's a sense that you're kind of left to figure it out yourself. And it's, I think, a huge mistake to do that. And I think that certainly films reflect our attitudes towards sex and sexuality and gender as well. So I think... if there's a healthier attitude towards things, you may actually get perhaps less lazy horror films in that sense. But I think it's, Ginger Snaps, I think the tagline was, it's not called The Curse for Nothing or something. You know, great, great tagline. Number two as well, I think they actually did it for number two. But really old trope, as you said, Becky, the female agency and sexuality is seen as it's threatening the status quo, and it's the patriarchal status quo, so it must be destroyed or tamed or defeated somehow. And it's kind of I think it's very much strikes at the heart of Western society in many ways. If I can get a little bit, possibly sound a bit pompous, but I'm going to go for it. Okay. Yeah, there's Puritan attitudes towards it actually can be quite surprising as well. Bill Bryson, who I just love as an author, there was a tradition in Puritan times of tarrying or bundling. And it was a case of a male visitor to a household, if they stay the night, and if they had daughters, presumably teenage daughters, it was a sort of almost courtesy to offer the daughters to actually tarry or bundle with the visitor if they so desired, which was basically went to bed. It was kind of like quite nice. Like, if you wish to tarry with my daughter, sort of thing. And if a child came from that, then there would be an expectation of marriage, etc. And there was no, I don't think there was an obligation to actually bundle or tarry with the daughter, but it was kind of, they were almost like offered up. And it was kind of, whoa, okay, that's not as repressed as we might like to think, but it's just, it's almost worse in a way that there's, you know, you can have my teenage daughter help yourself. It's like, what?
Yeah.
So I may have misread that, but the way it was described was very much, it was a lot less repressed they were quite earthy, but in other senses, they didn't enjoy themselves very much. It was kind of, okay. Or there was actually a very conflicted views about pleasure, which I think this film captures really well.
Yeah.
But it was the helplessness, I think, for me that was scary. You just knew this family were doomed. There was a sort of sense of almost crushing claustrophobic inevitability of doom about this family, that it was all going to go very, very badly wrong. And it did. It was quite a bleak film for me. And that's what I think unsettled me the most.
And, you know, that isolation that we talked about and that claustrophobia, it's like, it's more than even they're isolated from their community because they've been shut out, but they're also isolated from where they've come from, because this is about people coming from Britain to America to settle. And so they've actually gone into a completely different world as well than they're used to, and presumably different climates and different kind of, you know, crop growing and everything. The whole thing is new to them and is a different world. And that is, again, I don't know, it sort of really compounds that feeling of helplessness they might feel.
Yeah, definitely. I think, again, they were on the verge of starving, the Puritans. The First Nations, they actually took pity on them and helped them out. And they said, well, actually, there's all these amazing foods you can help yourself to. And they didn't. I think their crops kept failing. There was like various new diseases that kept killing their crops off. And they were in a bad way, I think, in the first half of the 17th century. It was very, very tenuous, their existence. If it hadn't been for the First Nations, they probably would have died out, but and then history would have been very different. But
it perhaps explains some of the religiousness of them as well. So obviously they've gone as these groups, as they've gone within their kind of religious groups, but I think that probably made their religion more fervorous, because they're praying for their survival, and they have to believe that they're there for a reason and that they can do this. So I think that probably increased their fundamentalism trifold, to be honest.
Yeah, it's life or death, you know, and it really was, I think. And I think, I mean, they were pretty intolerant to begin with as well, because I think one of the reasons why they went to America was they wanted to establish their own kind of intolerant religious sort of colonies. It wasn't, you know, because they weren't welcomed in England. It's like, right, we'll go off somewhere else and do it. And it's like, okay, so they just doubled down, I think is the phrase. And on their beliefs, which questionable, but you know, there we go.
I mean, I guess the idea of the frontier is very kind of important in a lot of kind of American cinema and stuff, and you know, mostly the Western, but then it seems to be more of a development of like frontier horror kind of recently, which is interesting.
Yes. Any other examples?
I can only think of that Bone Tomahawk.
Oh, God, yes. Oh, yeah. Didn't get on with that, actually.
No, it was a bit much.
So thank you very much, Toby, for coming to talk to us about The Witch, which is a scary film. I would say, again, for me, I didn't feel scared by this film, but like some of the films that we have watched where I have genuine fear. I just found this film very unsettling. It disturbed me, but it didn't stay for me in the way that it did for you. And I think that's quite interesting.
Yes. Yeah, it could have just been where I was at the time in my head. I don't know. It resonated for possibly longer than I would have liked. St. Maud was quite disturbing for me as well, but it didn't resonate the same. It was interesting.
Did you find it stayed with you, or did you find it scary?
No, I mean, the first time I saw it, I just found it disappointing and I thought not a lot happened, and then I forgot about it. But actually, I did enjoy it more a second time. It didn't scare me. I mean, there was some, you know, some imagery that was shocking, and there's some kind of jumpy bits. But then overall, I was just like, let's all be witches.
You came out with a bit more of triumph at the end.
Yeah.
Interesting what Robert Eggers would say to that.
It's like, heck yeah, witches.
Yeah, it would be interesting.
Living deliciously now, Holly.
Always.
Always.
I've got guacamole in the fridge.
Hey. Oh, yeah.
So, Toby, if people want to hear your podcast, where can they find it?
I'm glad you asked. It's called Dr. Kino's Film Emporium, and it's available on all good streaming sites as well. So I think there's about 18 or 20 episodes. Nothing in the new year, but that will change. I'm gearing up to try and to get an episode together. So yes, thank you very much for that. And
and your podcast focuses on kind of hidden gems, doesn't it?
It is indeed, yes. So it's about underrated, undervalued and under the radar classics that people may or may not be aware of. So we've got a number of choices, some of which I didn't agree with, but the person doing it did a pretty good job. Your own choice was a absolute, sounds like, I haven't seen it yet, but it's a Brian De Palma, what was it called again? The
Phantom of the Paradise.
Phantom of the Paradise, thank you, which is this bizarre musical effort, which just sounds a really interesting view. Sounds definitely like a cult film that hasn't surfaced yet. So yes, undervalued, underrated and underappreciated films. And yeah, we've got a very, very wide eclectic range, as you'd expect. So I've come across some gems, which I will be checking out when I get the time.
Excellent. Brilliant. Thank you for coming to talk to us.
No problem. Thank you very much indeed for having me. It's been great.
Thank you.
And if you want to reach out to us, please find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'd love to hear from you. And we'd love your recommendations of films that we should talk about. And we will see you next time. Thank you very much. Bye.
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 You are listening to Panic Pixie Scream Girls, a podcast by Becky Lewis-Jones and Holly Parsons, edited by Gareth Lewis-Jones.